Now we turn to energy policy. Environmental Protection Agency head Scott Pruitt issued a proposed rule that would repeal the Clean Power Plan, which was aimed at curbing greenhouse gas emissions from existing U.S. power plants.
The plan is an Obama-era policy, but had been blocked from taking effect by the U.S. Supreme Court while lower courts assessed lawsuits against it.
Richard Revis is a professor of environmental law in the New York University School of Law, and he's also the author of several books, including Struggling for Air, Power Plants, and The War on Coal. Richard, welcome to Central Time. Richard, are you with us?
I am.
There we go. Now I can hear you. What did you make of this announcement from the EPA?
Well, it wasn't surprising. This was in the air for a long time, so we were expecting it. What is surprising is the breadth of the attacks on environmental law that are contained in the proposal.
What kind of attacks?
Well, I mean, for one thing, it's a proposal to repeal the Clean Power Plan, which is the most significant U.S. regulation of greenhouse gas emissions. So that's very important. But in order to get there, they attack the underpinnings of a lot of environmental regulation. So the Trump administration is trying in this proposal to make the Clean Power Plan's repeal look economically supportable. And the problem is that it is not economically supportable. So in order to make it look economically supportable, they mangle the estimates of costs and benefits so that the costs look much larger than they are, the benefits look a lot lower than they are. But in lowering the benefit estimates, they do damage that would have far-reaching consequences beyond just the Clean Power Plan.
Right, and you wrote an opinion piece in the New York Times about this, getting at what you see as a mangling of the numbers to justify the rollback of the Clean Power Plan. Can you take us through some of your argument? For instance, the costs of the plan.
Sure. They mangled both the costs and the benefits. On the cost side, the Clean Power Plan would have led to somewhat more expensive, a more expensive price of electricity per unit of electricity, but it would have also led to energy efficiency measures, which would have led to having less electricity needed. So the total cost of electricity was going to go up as a result of one factor, the higher cost of producing it, but down as a result of another factor, the less amount needed because of energy efficiency improvements. So what the Trump administration does is it fails to consider the energy savings as a cost reduction and just looks at the one factor, the one that increases the cost of electricity. So they then say, as Scott Pruitt said today, that the Clean Power Plan would cost $33 billion a year. But that is only if electricity that is purely imaginary, they would never be produced because it wouldn't be needed, were actually produced and paid for. It is total fiction. Because as I indicated, the Clean Power Plan would lead to savings in the amount of electricity needed as a result of these energy efficiency improvements.
You also say that the EPA reduced estimates to account for domestic impact, just the United States, and not a more global impact. How does that change things?
They do two things. They first, for greenhouse gas emissions, they reduce the benefit estimates, and then they also reduce the benefits estimates of for the health benefits of local pollutants that would be reduced as a result of the Clean Power Plan. So on the greenhouse gas side, there is an estimate of the benefit of greenhouse gas emissions called the social cost of carbon. It's been in place. It was in place during almost all of the Obama administration, and it's required by a decision of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco. And it dates back to 2008. And then in 2016, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit in Chicago held that the Obama administration's number, which is a global estimate of the global benefits of carbon dioxide emissions, was a reasonable number. So the Trump administration now says that it's not going to use a global number, even though carbon dioxide is a global pollutant and has global adverse impacts. It's going to somehow or other use a subset of that number, a much lower number, which it calls the domestic estimate. But what it calls a domestic estimate overlooks the fact that the U.S. suffers adverse consequences not only from greenhouse gas emissions in the United States, but also from greenhouse gas emissions in other countries. It also overlooks the fact that the U.S. actions in this area have an impact on what other countries do. So if the U.S. acts irresponsibly, it makes it more likely that other countries will act irresponsibly as well, for example, to consider only a number that's domestic from their perspective. And the additional greenhouse gas emissions would have adverse consequences on the United States. So what they call a domestic number is a misnomer. It has no support in economic theory. It is not a real thing. It is just an arbitrary way of cutting down on the estimates, on the proper estimates of the benefits of greenhouse gas reductions.
Richard Revis is a law professor at NYU. He stays with us as we continue to look at the EPA's proposed plan to do away with the Clean Power Plan.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this decision? Should the United States stick with a Clean Power Plan and implement it, or are you glad to see the Trump administration working to overturn it? Call in now at 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And we'll continue the conversation in a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're continuing to look at the future of energy policy under the Trump administration. Richard Revis stays with us. He's a professor of environmental law at New York University Law School.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. The Trump administration is looking to end the Obama-era policy, the Clean Power Plan, that's been tied up in courts. Do you think that's a good idea, bad idea? Was it overreached by the Obama administration, or was it what the United States needs to do to control climate change pollution? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And Richard, I want to ask you, Senate Environment and Public Works Committee Chairman John Barrasso, a Republican from Wyoming, said it, meaning the Clean Power Plan, would have hurt energy workers in Wyoming and harmed the state's economy. Is he right about that? How would this have impacted energy workers?
Well, I assume he was referring to people in the coal industry, coal miners, and people generally working in the coal industry. Unfortunately, coal has been in decline for a long time, but it's not primarily because of environmental regulation. Coal has been in decline primarily because of the low prices of natural gas as a result of fracking, and also because of the quick introduction of renewables, which are now a lot cheaper to produce than they used to be. So the Clean Power Plan is not going to have an appreciable, the repeal of the Clean Power Plan, even if it ultimately happens and is ultimately upheld by the courts, which I doubt will be the case, is unlikely to have much of an impact on coal workers in Wyoming or elsewhere.
So what happens to those coal jobs?
Well, that is a serious social problem, and we should be thinking as a society on how to provide opportunities for people who've devoted their lives to these endeavors that now are not economically viable because circumstances have changed. And whether it's retraining, whether it's economic development measures that bring other jobs to the areas or whatever it is, I think that's a serious issue that deserves serious attention, which it's not getting because instead we engage in these acrimonious debates about whether the Obama administration's regulations caused this problem or not. And it's obscuring a serious social problem that is not going away no matter what happens to the Clean Power Plan.
I want to take a caller now. We've got Vic joining us in Amherst Junction. Vic, hello.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate it. I just wanted to say that I totally think that the Clean Power Plan is future-minded, and I agree with your speaker about the offset. We have to look at, the job losses, and I think that really needs to be seriously looked at. But I kind of think that we can have our cake and eat it too, especially when we look toward the future.
And what are you thinking of when you say that?
Well, what I'm thinking of is I think the job solution is going to take a lot of thought and a lot of time. And I also think that when I think about my kids and the future, that's the other part of, you know, having your cake and eat it too, that we can have clean air. You know, I often ask young kids I teach, and I say, how many of you really want clean air? I mean, there's nobody who says they don't. And this is not the silver bullet, but it is part of a solution, a bigger solution to a problem that we have right now that we have to deal with, and that's greenhouse gases.
Vic, thank you for that call. And Richard, can we have our cake and eat it too when it comes to clean energy and jobs and the economy and all of that?
Definitely. I completely agree with your caller. There is no strong evidence that these environmental regulations in the aggregate lead to a loss in jobs. They might lead to some shifting around of jobs. There are obviously a lot of jobs in the renewable sector, in solar and wind. And as energy shifts in that direction, there are new jobs created. There are also some jobs lost. I mean, most studies show that the impact of regulation on jobs is minimal. In some cases, it's slightly positive. In some cases, it's slightly negative. But it's almost always very small. The opponents of regulation raise this jobs issue as some strong argument against regulation, but they're just mangling the economic analysis. I think we can have our cake and eat it, and we must have our cake and eat it because we're creating very serious global problems by not addressing this issue. If the U.S. doesn't do it, other countries ultimately over the long run won't either. We have to be leaders in this area. And also because these measures to reduce greenhouse gases have enormous health benefits in the United States because they reduce other pollutants, like particulate matter, that have an impact on public health. So, for example, the Clean Power Plan would save 3,600 lives a year. And even if some jobs would be lost as a result of it, which is not totally clear, it's probably a smaller number. So by delaying it or repealing it, we would create more dead people than unemployed, than the unemployed people who might get their jobs back if there are any of those.
Richard, even without the Clean Power Plan, greenhouse gas emissions are projected to decrease. Is that rate enough?
Well, they have been decreasing so far, and that's because natural gas continues to be cheap and renewables have been introduced at a faster rate than the Obama administration estimates had had anticipated. So that's been good. It has not been uniform, so in some states there have not been significant improvements, and others there have been. But it's risky to continue doing this without the regulatory measure, because tomorrow some market condition might change, natural gas might become expensive, and then suddenly we would lose all of these gains. The only way to ensure the gains of the long run is to have a regulatory program in place like the Clean Power Plan.
And as we start to wrap up, Richard, what happens next? Is this a question for the courts?
Well, it will be a question for the courts eventually. So right now, the administration today announced the proposed rule. The next step is it will publish this rule in the Federal Register, maybe in a few days, maybe in a few weeks. Then there'll be a 60-day comment period where any interested party or entity can file comments. There are going to be tons of comments filed on this rule. After that, the agency has a legal obligation to respond to all material comments and explain why it disagrees with them to the extent it disagrees with them. Once it's done with that, it publishes the final rule. And then the final rule will definitely be challenged. Then the case will go to the courts. It'll initially go to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, and it could conceivably eventually.
And we leave it there. Richard Rev is with us, a professor of environmental law at the New York University School of Law and the author of several books, including Struggling for Air, Power Plants, and the War on Coal. He joined us for a look at the EPA announcement about a proposed repeal of the Clean Power Plan.
The new state budget makes changes to the food assistance program. Governor Walker wants permission from the federal government to administer drug tests to food share recipients and impose work requirements. Shemaine Mills looks at how this could shift the safety net for people who now rely on government help.
2 years ago, Wisconsin required able-bodied adults to work in order to receive food stamps, known as food share. Thousands were dropped from the program. Now the work requirement has been expanded to parents of school-age children. Eligibility for food share could shrink and reliance on food pantries grow, not only because of state changes, but billions of dollars in proposed cuts at the federal level. All this worries Tammy Butler. She relies on food share to feed herself and her two kids. While waiting in line for free groceries at a rural food pantry in August, she explained she can't work and hasn't been able to get disability benefits either.
I've been waiting for 5 years. I hurt my back. I've got kidney disease, a liver disease. I use the food pantries. You know, I barely make it.
David Lee is executive director of Feeding Wisconsin, a trade group for six regional food banks. He's also concerned about changes to food assistance.
The emergency food system was not designed to do the work of the federal government. We are designed to work in partnership to fill in gaps.
Over the years, the social safety net has expanded and contracted as attitudes, politics, and economies changed. When the Great Recession receded, Wisconsin and other states implemented a federal work requirement that had been waived because of lack of jobs. Then in January of this year, Governor Walker announced he would build on the reforms initiated by his predecessor, Tommy Thompson.
You know, we are good and decent people in this state. We will help people when they were down and out, but for those who are able, public assistance should be a trampoline, not a hammock.
At the time, the state's largest business group, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, said the current safety net created a disincentive to work. Companies were having trouble finding employees. David Lee says that's because some can't get to a job or find work that pays the bills.
I think the question on self-reliance is, look, a good job is the best anti-hunger tool, right? The question then becomes, are there good jobs?
A UW-Madison report found poverty is down in the state and unemployment has declined. But Lee says many of the jobs available are only part-time or pay poorly.
The jobs that are coming back are not the jobs that we had pre-recession. There are more lower-wage jobs. People are working less hours.
The state says it's had success in linking food share recipients to jobs and job training. A recent report showed 18,000 food share participants working for an average of 33 hours a week for $12 an hour. All were able-bodied adults without dependents. Governor Walker indicated in January he wanted even more people working for food.
We now want to have adults who have children who are school age enter the workforce as well. And so we're going to, in our proposal, enact a similar requirement that says you need to be employed at least 80 hours a month.
The state report on food share employment showed only 30% of those referred to the work program actually enrolled. Lee says that's not good enough.
We are supportive of programs that help connect people to work, but work training programs have to work.
Advocates for the poor say reforms intended to help may cause some to fall through the cracks as the safety net shifts when state and national policies change. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.